Thank you. So as I was thinking about this evening, I wanted to share what I want to tell a little bit of the story of why I organized this evening or why I reached out to Dawn Farms to have a session during Alcohol Awareness Month. So the question in my head is, has anything changed since 1974? We have bike helmets, people. We don't smoke in restaurants anymore. Children don't ride in the back seats of station wagons without seat belts. We do a lot of things differently today than we did then. But my father, back in 1974, had an undiagnosed, unrecognized disease that he died of. And I wonder to myself if things have changed that much today. So I thought the way I could help address that would be to partner with Dawn Farms and have a chance to hear and to teach or share some of the knowledge that we have today that I know is different than what most people had in 1974 about addiction and alcoholism. So I reached out to Dawn Farm, and the clinical director led me to Anna Byberg, who's the program coordinator at Spera Recovery Center on West Huron. So I welcome Anna. She's going to talk a little bit about addiction and set some of the foundation for the book and the narrative that the book displays of the life course of alcoholism and the legacy of alcoholism. So thank you.
Thank you. Hi, everyone. Thanks, Lisa, for inviting me here today. So my name is Anna Byberg, and I'm the program coordinator at Dawn Farms Spera Recovery Center. And I think most of you might be familiar with Dawn Farm, but we provide treatment and recovery support services for people with addictions to alcohol and other drugs. And my job today is really to talk a little bit about the nuts and bolts of addiction, so do a mini addiction 101. So I'm going to start by talking about the different types of substance use. So I'm going to, this is a little awkward because I need to write things on the board and then come back to the microphone, so I'm going to do that. Okay, so the first type of use is just substance use, and this is using a substance in the way that it was intended. So, for example, if you're of age and have a glass of wine with dinner, or you have a medical procedure and take prescribed narcotics as prescribed, that's using a substance, but it's not using in any kind of problematic way. The next category is misuse, and that's just using a substance in a way other than as it was intended. So if I'm prescribed one pill, I take two pills instead, or I'm using it in a way that's different than what it was intended, how it was intended to be used. Abuse really starts to incorporate consequences. So as a result of my misuse, I'm having consequences. So maybe I drink too much alcohol and the next day I have a hangover. That's a consequence. Or maybe I have a DUI when I'm using, or I don't show up for work, or in some way something is happening. What's important about the first three categories of use, use, misuse, or abuse, is that I still have control over my using in those categories. So if I say I'm not going to use drugs or alcohol today, I'm able to refrain from using. Addiction is its own entity. Addiction is really an illness, and it's very encompassing and impacts the person holistically. So what we're going to focus on, or what I'm going to focus on today, is talking about what makes addiction different than those other types of using. And there's three main things that I like to focus on. One is that addiction is primary, and that just means that it's not the secondary side effect of some other primary problem that I have. So I'm not using drugs or alcohol because of my fill-in-the-blank. I'm using because I have a primary problem of addiction. Addiction is also progressive, which just means it gets worse over time. And it's chronic, which means it's something that someone has over a long term. So addiction is often compared to other chronic illnesses like diabetes. And if you compare the follow-through rate of patients with most chronic illnesses, they're approximately the same. Diabetes, hypertension, addiction, it's usually in the 30 to 40% range, so it's not great, but it's not much worse than other chronic illnesses. So Our goal in providing treatment services for people is really to help them figure out what they need to do on a daily basis in order to stay sober and stable in recovery. And those are the things that are going to sustain someone over the long term. Okay, so addiction impacts people biologically, psychologically, socially, and spiritually. And we're going to focus on biological, psychological, and social. Okay, so when people are biologically addicted to something, they tend to have physical dependence on that substance. So as an example, right now I don't have any drugs or alcohol in my system. This is baseline for me, no drugs or alcohol. If I was to drink 6 beers per night for the next month, then my new baseline is six beers of alcohol, right? In order to get some kind of effect from the alcohol then, what do I need to do? I need to increase the amount that I'm drinking. And so now let's say I progress and I'm drinking a fifth a day, and that's my baseline. And so I'm up here presenting similar to how I'm presenting right now, so you don't even notice really because my body's baseline is that amount of alcohol. So what happens if I abruptly discontinue drinking? Right, so I'll have physical withdrawal. And that will look different depending on my own body chemistry, what I've been drinking or what I've been using, how long I've been using. But I'll have, my body will say baseline, the equilibrium is offset here. And so you'll go into withdrawal. So is physical dependence the same as addiction? Who thinks it's the same? Who doesn't think it's the same? And who's not really sure? Okay, so let me give you an example. Let's say we're leaving tonight and everyone's really jazzed about the talk, and so somebody zips down the street without really paying attention, and one of you runs me over. So I'm not mad, but I'm hurt, and I end up in the hospital. And let's say I'm on an IV drip of morphine for the next 2 months while I'm repaired and I'm undergoing surgeries and those sorts of things. If at the end of that 2-month period of morphine, I abruptly stop taking the morphine, what will happen? I'll go into withdrawal. And then one of two things will happen. Either I will say, oh, this was a terrible experience. I got to get through this. Maybe I don't even recognize that what I'm feeling is withdrawal, but I just know I feel like not well. And I get through that and I get like, can't wait to put this behind me, get back to work and just get back on track with my life. Or I say something clicked when I was taking that morphine and I need to figure out how to get more of that. So maybe if I go back to the doctor and I say my ankle's still sore or my ribs are hurting or something's not quite right with me, maybe I'll be able to get more of that because it felt really right when I was using it. And for about 8 to 10% of the population, they will experience that second, they will have that second experience. And it's not because of any moral failing. It's not because of anything that was different in their experience. It's just a different way that their bodies are processing that substance. So there's a genetic component to addiction too, or something biologically that's different about people who have addiction than people who don't have addiction. Most of us have had an experience where we had alcohol or we took a narcotic for some medical procedure, but most people aren't addicts. And so no matter how much of that you use, you won't be an addict if you're not. Sometimes we say it's sort of a joke. Once you're a pickle, you can't be a cucumber again. Yeah. So people are either pickles or they're cucumbers, and it's... All right, so the important part that really distinguishes addiction from other types of use are these psychological symptoms, this craving, obsession, preoccupation. And depending on whether you're going to a 12-step group or you're looking at the DSM, it's going to be different in how it's described, but they're really talking about the same thing. So this feeling like, I wonder how much longer this is going to be before I can go to the bathroom and get high or before I can go to the bar and get a drink. You're constantly thinking about it, and it's really taking up a lot of space in your head. And you have loss of control. So I can say, on my way home from work tonight, I'm going to stop at the bar and I'm going to have one drink. And then what happens? I have more, or I don't know what's going to happen. Maybe some days that works, but then other days it doesn't work, and there doesn't seem to be any discernible difference on my action part that can help me predict what's going to happen. So I have loss of control. Or I say, I've been using heavily, and I know it's been a problem, and I really got to get this under control. So I say, I wake up in the morning, and I say, I'm not going to get high today. Today is the day. And then what happens? I get high. And that's not the promise I'm making to my PO or to my significant other or to my mom or to my anybody else. That's the commitment I'm making to me, and I still can't follow through with that. And so how do you think people feel when they're in that psychological grasp of addiction?
Trapped.
Trapped, terrible.
Overwhelmed,
freaked out. And so we tend to think about substance use or addiction as a hedonistic pursuit, as something people just wanting to feel better all the time. Because most of us who are not addicts, our experience with drugs or alcohol can be positive. So I go to the ball game and I have a beer, or I take this medication and it makes me feel better. So it's hard if you don't have addiction or don't have experience with addiction to understand that it doesn't feel like that for people who have addiction. They're out of control. Things are spiraling and they can't come out of the spiral. So we talk about Maslow's hierarchy of needs at this point. All right, does anyone remember what's on the bottom level of this hierarchy?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's your basic physical needs, your basic physiological needs. So food, water, sex, shelter, those sorts of things. So in addiction, we also talk about your midbrain being hijacked into believing that the thing that you're addicted to is as important as those other things. So it's food, water, shelter, alcohol, food, water, shelter, heroin, whatever you happen to be using. And when I've given this talk to people who are in recovery, they say it's really more important than those things. Because if it's use or eat today, I'm using. If it's use or pay my rent so I have a place to live, I'm using. And it's not even a choice. It's just my brain is telling me this is the most primary need that I have. And the nature of this hierarchy is that only when I have that bottom level satisfied can I move up to my higher level needs. So only then can I be working on safety or relationships or up to the point of self-actualization. And sometimes we think about people being developmentally stunted at the point at which they started using heavily or they were really active in their addiction. And I think this is a way of explaining why that is. Because I'm not working on that other stuff if I'm always trying to get my addiction satisfied. And the nature of addiction is that it's unsatisfiable. Never will I say that was enough alcohol or that was enough of whatever I'm using. So another thought example that we try out is around interventions. So are people somewhat familiar with interventions? So you walk into a room and all your closest loved ones are there, and you know right away what's up. They're all sitting in a circle and they have their letters, and they read you these letters and we say, we love and care about you so much. And we would like you, so imagine you walk into this room, all your people are there, and they say, we care about you so much, we are really concerned about your eating, and we want you to not eat anymore. And we know it feels impossible, and we're going to send you to this treatment center, we've got it all set up, and you're going to learn how to live your life food-free. Don't worry, you're going to take a tasteless horse pill every day that will meet your nutritional requirements, so you're not going to die of starvation, but you're never going to taste food again. We really want you to do it. What's your reaction to that? Forget it. That sounds awful. That's impossible. How might you act? Hostile, dismissive. You might say, sure, I'm going to do that. And you're like, there is no way I'm doing that. Might you sneak food anyway and then lie about it when you got caught? Might you lash out? Might you run away? And would you be doing any of those things because you're a bad person or you have a moral failing? No, that, yeah, exactly. You believe in what you need. That is a normal reaction to a situation where someone is putting in jeopardy something that feels vital to your existence. And so as friends and family members and helping professionals, when we're on the receiving end of those kind of behaviors, it's really easy to take that personally or to feel like something's wrong in the process. And it's really part of it. That's the defense mechanism protecting the addiction. And that's really the addiction running the show. Another thing that's very important is that we have this laser-sharp division of the person and their addiction. The person is on our team. Our loved one is in there somewhere. They want to be sober. They want to have a happy life. They want all the same things that we want. The addiction is really twisting up and distorting that person. And so sometimes when we're having a conversation with someone who's active in their addiction, like, we can say, I'm talking to the addiction right now. And then when you're talking to the person, that feels different. That's a different kind of conversation. So we're on the team with the person trying to fight against the addiction. And in that situation, the intervention example, we're talking to the addiction. So let's say we had this intervention and I yelled at grandma. But let's say that I said, fine, I'll just do whatever you want. I surrender. And I went to the treatment center. When I start to process what that experience was like, how do you think I feel about my behavior toward grandma?
You feel bad.
Yeah.
Very guilty.
Yeah, the shame and guilt. So we talk a ton about that too. No one feels good about the things that they did in active addiction in order to stay active in their addiction. They felt necessary at the time, but with hindsight, it feels terrible to have done those things and to have acted in those ways. And so talking about that in recovery is very, very important. And then the last category is social. So the first thing that happens socially, usually, is some sort of changing peer group. So humans want to feel a sense of belonging. And if I start to use in a way that is different than the people around me, I'm going to seek out people who are using in the way that I'm using so that that feels more normal. This is okay. These other people are using in the same way. I have this collection, so that feels better. And if there are people that I have previously been close to that are concerned about my use, I want to try to distance myself from them because it's uncomfortable to have that dissonance of being around people that aren't using the way that I'm using. I also think of addiction as this U-shape. So the addiction is there, and when I'm early in my using, my life is still full. So that's this top part with the wide circle. I have a job, I have a family, I have leisure activities I like to do, I have friends. And as I get deeper and deeper into my addiction, those things slip away. So let's say I stop going to school, or I get fired from my job, or the people I used to hang out with, I don't want to spend time with them anymore, so I'm changing my peer group. I used to like to play ice hockey, and I'm not doing that anymore because it's just, I don't have time for it. It's getting in the way. And so things are getting more narrowly wound around my active use until at the bottom of that circle, it's really just me and the drink or me and the drug. And there's not a whole lot else going on, and I'm super isolated. And at that point, people usually have a breaking point. So it's not uncommon at all that people describe feeling suicidal in that moment, or there's something has to give. Either I'm going to check out, or I'm going to reach out and ask for help and see if that happens, or I'm going to do something and try to get myself in jail, but something needs to give. I cannot continue the way that this has been going. And so when someone comes into recovery, it's super important that we address all of these different things. So in the biological section, it's very important that we break that cycle of building a physical dependence and a tolerance on the substance, and then withdrawal. So using and stopping and using and stopping. And sometimes you'll see people deep in those cycles where they just hold on and try to use as much as they can, and then hold on and try to stop using for as long as they can, and hold on and try to use as much as they can. Mm-hmm. And we really need to discontinue that. So going fully through your detox.
It's kind of the hamster
wheel. Exactly. You're following the cycle, and you got to break out of that somehow. It's also super important to start talking about those feelings. So when I do stop using, all this guilt and shame and all these feelings that have been sort of suppressed by the substance that I'm using come up and feel super raw and super fresh. So it's important that I have a safe place that I can talk about those things. Sometimes that's a treatment center. Sometimes that's 12-step meetings. There's lots of different ways that can look, but I need to have that outlet to talk about what's going on with me in a situation where people understand and aren't judging. And then social, we start to move back up this loop and start reintroducing some of those positive social activities again, rebuilding a support network, finding employment again, practicing hobbies again, whatever we need to do in order to have that full life. The addiction doesn't go away, so it's still present, but it doesn't need to be so tightly wound just around that. We're expanding. Does this make sense?
Yes.
Okay. Does anyone have any questions? But addiction really needs isolation in order to survive. It needs people to not talk about it. So one thing that's super important for all of us really is to talk openly about what the realities of addiction are, especially if there is addiction in your family, because there is a genetic component. And so to talk about that, like you will have opportunities to use drugs or alcohol. This might be some of the things you might have, this craving and preoccupation when you use, and you don't understand where that's coming from, or you think that's just how everybody is reacting to this, and it isn't how everyone's reacting to this. So having those sort of open conversations is a very helpful preventative factor.
What a perfect segue. So it's really an important refresher. I feel like every couple of years I need to hear this talk, just because it gives me a framework. When you're talking to a friend who has a story, there's something going on with a cousin or something, it's a framework that you can remember. So I really, really appreciate hearing that again, because I've unfortunately had to hear it a few other times in my life. I'm going to give a reading from a book that I wrote called The Lost Chapters. I published it this last year myself, and it's a book that's a memoir. It's part biography, and I debated for a while whether it should be a novel or whether I should write nonfiction, because it had all the elements. There's a death, there's sex, there was a villain in my mind, and there was a plot, and so I felt like there was an opportunity there if I'd wanted to, but really there was a message I wanted to share. And so I think a more effective way to share that with my family and with the world was to use nonfiction. So it has three narrative threads, however. One is the story of my father's life and his family background and his career. The other is my quest to find out more about him. I had to unravel a whole lot of things to try and find out exactly what happened to him at the end of his life, which I didn't know when I started this. And the third is that I had every writer's absolute opportunity when I found a manuscript that he wrote in my mother's house. And so I had original material, his voice, his thoughts to work with and to use as sort of a fundamental piece of the story. So I love family history. If you wanted to, I would curl up with you in the corner over here and we could talk about your grandparents or your parents, and because I think those stories are wonderful, and it's a way to learn both cultural history and also lessons that we can share with each other, and especially with our children. I think it's really important to know where you come from and who you come from. It informs our actions and it informs our relationships. So that was an important part of this book as well, that there's a lot of family and social history in here. But as a writer, my muse are, to a large extent, things, artifacts from around us. And I find I get inspiration from them, but also technically they give me an opportunity to go deep, to describe something. And so I get inspired by them. Things like documents or photographs or pieces of cloth or art or buildings, different furniture, different things I used as inspiration when I was writing this, and I'll give you an example a little bit later. So a couple of books are really good illustrations of this technique, and if you like this kind of thing, Edmond Duwas wrote a book called The Hare with the Amber Eyes. And it's a story that he followed the life of the journey of these small sculptures that are called netsuke. They're Japanese objects, beautiful little art objects that his ancestors own in Europe. They were very wealthy Jews in similar to the Rothschilds in Vienna. They came from Odessa in Russia, became hugely wealthy, and then lost everything and were persecuted under the Nazis. And so he's a potter in London, a famous potter, and he decided to follow the story of these objects, and he basically told the history of Europe through these objects. It's a fabulous book called The Hare with the Amber Eyes. And the other one that I love is by a man named Russell Shorto, which is called the the island at the center of the world, which is the history of Manhattan, that recently they found a whole bunch of documents that are written in 17th century Dutch. And he used those, although when he wrote them, the whole thing wasn't completely translated yet, but he used them as a primary resource to tell the story of how Manhattan really happened and the remarkable society that was Manhattan Island. So those are two sort of examples that I kind of found inspiration and guidance and sisterhood, I guess, or brotherhood from other authors. And so what I had were clippings and magazine clippings and newspaper clippings and letters and a photo album, which my father created during just after his tour in Germany, where he included small, it's a black photo album, and he used white lettering to just put little bits of information about the pictures. And I used magnifying glasses and went deep on all these pictures and were able to tell a story just based on the photo album. And so it was very inspirational for me doing that. So I grew up in a household where advertising was part of everyday life. It infused everything that we did. And so I wanted to start off with a reading about that. My family used Crest toothpaste. It was the only toothpaste my mother ever bought, ever. In fact, her steadfast brand loyalty probably influenced my classifying other brands as other than de rigueur. At a sleepover when I was 9 or 10, I was introduced to Colgate's spicier flavor. At another house, I encountered the fire of Ultra Bright. I had this notion that the toothpaste you used, like what block you lived on in Manhattan, gave some kind of clue about who you were. Trying new toothpaste was dangerous business, a more potent mystery to me as a child than what other families ate for breakfast. Toothpaste was a big deal in our family, as was shampoo, floor wax, and whipped dessert topping. My father worked for Benton & Bowles, and Benton & Bowles advertised Crest. So Stonington, Connecticut is a small town in the east, Stonington really anchored my parents. It was my mother's family home, and it represented my father's aspirations. They lived in New York City, and they went to Connecticut. So there were clues about him in the ease that he exhibited there, and I wanted to share a little bit about that. Until I was around 6 years old, every Friday, the four of us would pile into my parents' highly impractical, cherry-red, drop-top convertible, single-grill 1958 Porsche Speedster. For the 2.5-hour trip to Stonington, at the time an undiscovered fishing village tucked in the southeast corner of Connecticut. Leaving 96th Street, we noisily motored across the Bronx, out of the city, and through New York's endless gray suburbs. Bruce and I made the best of the small, dark space beneath the convertible roof, in quotes, there are no back seats in a tub-style Porsche of that vintage, creating our games among the coats and canvas tote full of food. On our way to Stonington, we stopped for groceries at the A&P in Mystic. Dad, still in the New York ad man in a Burberry trench coat over his navy suit, would check the aisles for Prel shampoo and Uban coffee, his client's products, pointing out to us kids the importance of products placed at eye level. All three checkout clerks, the older woman in red jackets and hairnets, knew us. The manager, an icon of the small-town American grocer in a cap, red apron, and bow tie, would show Dad when one of his products he was looking for had been allotted another shelf foot. Despite his business attire, Dad appeared completely comfortable conversing and joking with the grocer and his girls. When Dad told them all that the Mystic Housewives would be asking for Lemon Pledge as soon as the new television campaign was launched, they listened as if to Gloria Vanderbilt herself. Wow. Writing this book was an incredibly rewarding process, and a part of that was about the people that I met. So I wanted to share a little with you of how that worked. Over a period of a few years while working full-time and raising three kids, I located and interviewed more than 30 people, among them musicians, executive headhunters, a psychologist, a journal editor, an insurance agent, and an ad man turned sculptor. Most hadn't retired yet. For those who'd been in advertising, only a few remained in the business. I was surprised to find them alive, actually. To me, they had all died in 1974. The friends and former agency people I called seemed eager to talk to me, relieved even. I think we all felt like we were breaking the silence. They had shared the early journey with Dad, navigated some dangerous shoals, but somehow they had made it through. They did what they had to. They were fired, changed jobs, changed careers, remarried. Why did they make it and he didn't? Was it because of his alcoholism? It seemed too simple. One of the first things I asked each of them was how they heard about his death and what was said. I learned on the subway one morning reading the New York Times that an old friend. I read the obituary, and when I got to the office, I called Edie. She said he got pneumonia in Japan. Several others said they heard it was a heart attack, like Dick's father. But the explanations didn't seem to fit. Most in the business speculated that drugs or alcohol had played a role. Of course, the few who had been in Japan knew pretty much what had happened. Others relied on the rumors. So I mentioned that I used artifacts to inspire my imagination, and it's something that is a technique in creative nonfiction, so I would suggest it. It's a good writing exercise to imagine the story that comes out of an object. So I'm going to share something with you that is, this was from the photo album. Packing and unpacking trunks, suitcases, instruments, music stands, and the bandstand day after day got old fast. Dick did what he had to as co-manager to arrange to extend a booking. They spent days at the Bremen Country Club working on their tans and sat poolside for a weekend in Nuremberg. But when they lingered a few days in the town that had no lake to sail or pool to swim in, the band members mostly stayed in bed, smoking and reading the 7729 SSEC trade paper at the Spotlight, and maybe listening to one of only a dozen records that they had between them. Between songs, they could hear Rose in her room playing the Hohner accordion she had bought. Dick finished 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea and passed on his copy to Harry. They were in a band. He played a sax and clarinet for a dance band called Fascinating Rhythm that was his tour of Germany in occupied Germany just after the war for a year and a half, 2 years. One afternoon in late fall on a short drive back to Erlangen from Nuremberg, they came upon evidence of the recent conflict in the dry fields outside of town. Jack, taking his turn at the wheel in his Kraut bop glasses, pulled over the shuttle to look at the American tank. The wind whipped across the field, and everyone stood impatiently beside the cold metal carcass, hands in their pockets while Jack readied his camera. After the picture, ignoring warnings from the girls, Dick climbed up the ladder and into the tank. Hank threw him his Army-issue winter hat with the ear flaps, and Jack took the picture, a youngster's grin peeking over the tank's turrets. They discovered crash scenes as well. One German ME-210, decal number 410226, rested in a field with the tail section, emblazoned with a swastika, at a right angle to the burned cabin and missing its nose altogether. Dick, in his full-length coat, managed to get in the foreground when someone snapped a photograph of the wreckage. He mounted it in his album with the caption, "My First Victory." Several of these posed pictures suggest to me that he'd missed something. As usual, I placed myself back 3 or 4 years and tried to imagine what the place looked like, he wrote in his album beneath one picture. I think he yearned for the Gary Cooper glory he imagined his brother and others who fought had experienced in 1943 to 1945. He had pictures in his head of his brother crouched in the plexiglass bubble nose of one of the 500 B-17s flying in formation across the English Channel. Yet he'd met plenty of blank-faced GIs at Penn State, men who had seen action in the chaotic final days of the war. They didn't describe a moment of triumph for being part of something great. But they were part of something great, and Dick was not unaware of the second-class status of coming into the European theater after the big show was over. I'm a big novel reader, and I believe that when you're reading a book, you have to kind of fall in love with the main character or the person that the book is around. And or like the person. It's really hard to stick with a book when you don't really like the characters. So I tried to shape him. I only knew him, and the challenge was, I only knew him as a young daughter. So I was 15 when he died, so I had to sort of conjure, try to figure out and portray who he was. In the early days, this is in about 1952 when he was just starting in advertising. In the early days, the doors kept opening, literally. Dick started in the mailroom at Foot, Cone, and Belding, a large traditional advertising agency with offices across the country. When he could, he walked the halls from floor to floor, reading the names on the brass plates, smiling at the pointy-toed shoes and slender ankles from beneath the secretarial desks. He handed the department secretaries the packages, manila folders, film reels, and envelopes with 6-cent stamps from his crammed cart. He remembered each heavy-lidded smile they returned to him, frosty pink or glossy red lips murmuring, "Thanks, hon." Knowing everyone in the building, that was the idea behind working in the mailroom. $40 a week, what a job. But the work was far from glamorous. I imagine you spent those days in the mailroom listening in on the conversations in the elevator and memorizing who was whom. To keep his head up and on someone's urging, between July and February, he took a class, Mark Wiseman's course in the Principles of Advertising Effectiveness. The class met on the fourth floor of the sorry-looking brownstone on West 45th Street. Surprisingly, some of his classmates turned out to be imaginative, get-to-the-point kind of people with a sense of humor like him. The few dullards, all destined for account work or management, Dick guessed, were easily forgettable. Wiseman ran an interactive class where the young men worked in groups, most of them smoking, ties pulled loose. They worked on campaign ideas from everything from insurance to ball bearings, from milk to real estate. Late in 1952, after only a few months of seasoning in the mailroom, they made Dick a copywriter with his own desk where he composed and advertised and edited advertisements for radio and print, as in magazines and newspapers. An observer of human subtlety, the art hanging in an executive's office, the less conservative cut of the suits sitting around the long table at the department meetings, Dick was learning the culture and adjusting his own behavior and style. One of the struggles I had with writing was putting together the context of this story. So it's you have this thread of a story, but you want to sort of lay a backdrop and give people a sense of what was happening in the culture. So I have three more readings. And in 1968, something happened in his career at Benton & Bowles. He'd been there for about 10 years, and it starts off. "Passed over." That's the phrase I remember, the neutral explanation. Vic Blody replaced the flexible and accommodating Al Goldman with Alvin Hampel, a hotshot from Young and Rubicon, Y&R. The two anointed knights in line to succeed Goldman had lost their place. As Martin Meyer wrote, advertising is an insecure occupation. Blody had taken a risk hiring Hampel, as one person said, the S.C. Johnsons, which is a company that makes floor wax, didn't want to know the Al Hampels of the world. Tom Ogden, a former B&B account man who was struggling with B&B's most conservative client, explained. Of course Dick couldn't stay. It wasn't even a question. Hampel, a bit of a phony in the way he assumed the staccato presentation style of his friend, comedian Buddy Hackett, but quick-witted and business-savvy, insisted they reorganize the department with new people he had brought with him. "I dig what Vic wants to do here, and I want to help him do it," Hampel told Advertising Age, which is a trade journal. The first week of January 1970, Dick slid over to Sullivan, Stauffer, Caldwell, and Bayless, SSC&B, to the dull gold building on 3rd Avenue. He took a creative position one rung below the one he had held. Although they'd covered Dick's promotion a year and a half earlier, this move went unnoticed by the trade papers or the New York Times. Dick and Jack Taylor had bandied about the idea of starting their own small agency. Could he have tried a different direction, crafted his own brand of advertising? Perhaps not. Dick was nurtured in the protective society of bigness. He needed to be able to go back to ground zero, but there was no way he was going to do that, Ed McCabe observed. Adding to his anxiety were headlines in the business rags, editorializing that advertising was becoming a young man's business. The guy over 40 was dead. So this book contemplates the cost of alcoholism, that alcohol robs some people of their humanity. Actually, it robs some people of their soul. So my father took a job in Japan in 1974 in May, and went to Tokyo and had never, didn't know these folks, and started at a new job. And he was leaving. He was leaving his marriage. His wife was divorcing him, and he went to a new job in Tokyo, Japan, in 1974. Right? Just imagine that. Dad had dinner his first week with Norman Kapler, who gushed examples of the cultural complexities of Tokyo. How when he first arrived in Tokyo, he had committed innumerable humiliating gaffes. The time he ordered vodka in a restaurant, only to learn from his translator to his Japanese colleagues, drinking clear grain alcohol was tantamount to putting one's boots on the table and belching. Norman thought that the Japanese needed to humiliate the Westerners and had numerous examples, including that they manipulated the language barrier to that end. To illustrate, Norman told him a story that had them both laughing like teenagers. A few weeks previous, the Japanese union representative had complained to YNR's expat creative director, David, it is unacceptable that every morning when you come into the office, you insult us. The Britisher's hand flew to his mouth. What do you mean? Every time you greet us for the day's work, you call us Japs, the man replied solemnly. Oh, no, no. I say, okay, let's go, chaps. Some days, Dad appeared to do all right at work. Clay Timmon found that in the beginning, Dad engaged in client meetings and produced as expected. He had a great stock of war stories, Stu said. People would sit around the office and tell stories about clients. He was very social and engaging conversationalist. But when he talked business, his attitude was, Gene Kummel sent me out to save the company. Dad's judgment was failing. His assertions to his colleagues across the hall in account management, had Gene in fact said this to him, were at best inappropriate. His arrogance worried his colleagues, and he was unpredictable. Despite briefings with Stu, Sandy Kornberg, and others ahead of time, at the first of that summer's numerous new product meetings, he leaned back in his chair with overplayed assurance and asked a direct question, cornering a senior Japanese account person. Later in the meeting, when asked his opinion, he had nothing to say and looked as if he'd been absent for the entire conversation. At client lunches with Japanese and international businessmen, he seemed to miss the point of or even be annoyed by the expected social formalities. He interrupted people. Standing in the airless humidity of Stu's office, going over the nuance of promoting Gillette products in various Far Eastern markets, he continued to come across like he knew better. The other expats began to avoid giving him work and kept him from clients. They suspected he was drinking, but no one said anything. So, I have the experience of writing this. It took me 10 years to do this. I wrote for two or three, starting in, I did sort of the research, and then a guy who was a friend of my dad's, who was a publisher, said, put it away for 5 years, just don't look at it. So I did, and then he was right, and I got back to it, and I had a lot more to see that I saw and that I wanted to do with it. But the process is one that I want to share, that writing a memoir or writing from experience is a very rewarding process, but there are some things I want to share that are, I guess, lessons. You know the way the top 10 that you hear about on, is it Letterman that does the top 10? Well, here are my top 10, but I'll start with number one. Choose your moment. When you're going to do something, when you're going to write a book, or choose your moment. Acknowledge the pain. Susan Morris, who's another author, who's a person I know, wrote a book called The Habit, and she joked with me actually that that we were classmates in high school, and she said her mother is still alive. She wrote her book about her family and all the dysfunction and things like this, but her mother's still alive, and I waited until my parents were both deceased before I did this. Be clear about your intentions. Are you doing this as personal therapy? Are you doing this to tell a story? Recognize your place in the story. Recognize fiction or bullshit when you hear it, because people are going to tell you what they think or what they want you to know. And sometimes it's hard, and learning how to do interviewing is a skill, and it took me a while to learn it. And some people have other truths, too. They have other understandings. So stick to researching a book. Reflect, is this the right thing to do? Sometimes you might hurt somebody or say something that's hurtful, and especially at the end, putting a book together, you need to ask for permission, go to people, or if you're not going to ask for permission, then you need to make peace with yourself about what you're going to say and what could happen as a result. Seek help from professionals or seek professional help. I think there are times where things come up when you're writing about a personal journey, and you need to go talk to people who know more than you about that process. And give credit is really important, and then learn something in the process. So as Ellen Key, who's an expatriate, was an expatriate, 19th century feminist, said, remember to live. So that's all I have. Questions or thoughts? I don't know if anybody's read the book who's here, but
So after doing this, what was the impact on you?
I think that I made peace with some things. I understood more about my mother, and she lived until 2000, and some of her decisions that I had harshly criticized for a long time. And also I think publishing a book, putting together a product from a piece of work was a very motivating and satisfying experience, getting done with something.
So my question before was, how did it impact you? And my second question is, what do you feel you took away from this about alcoholism and addiction and substance abuse?
That my family has there's a variety of alcoholics in my family. And that I do believe that you can arrest patterns and you can do things differently. You can teach your children. You can recognize warning signs. You can give people tools and you can talk about things. So I am a big believer in that. And I think doing this gave me more material to work with. My kids have read the book. My nephews and nieces have read the book. And having those conversations, it's really about communication and open communication. For my mother's sisters, for my father's brother, for that generation, I think it was much more difficult, and you didn't talk about these kinds of things. So I think you can in our culture, and I'm grateful for that.
Thank you, and congratulations.
Thank you.
I was wondering, you said you had that long break in there?
Yeah.
And what was it that got you started again? I might have some idea, but I can see lots of people, including myself, never picking it up again. So what was it that...
I got remarried. And had a very supportive partner who had this idea that this was a project that should be finished. And so he gave me permission and he gave me some financial support. And so I think that was a huge part of it, getting back into it. And also I had some living to do. Sometimes you can't write a book when you're living. Mm-hmm. And so I had some hard living to do and I got through that in those 5 years. So Sam Vaughan was very wise. And I think he gave that advice to various other people who were real, you know, famous writers that he worked with. He worked at Doubleday. He was a senior editor at Doubleday, and this was the advice that he gave in his life. Sometimes you need to put things away. There's other things going on. And it's amazing what you see. You know the way when you're just writing a letter or something, you put it away and you get back to it the next day? I tell my kids to do that when they're writing their papers at school. It just, you see things. They just jump out to you. And I was able also to write more creatively when I went back to it, which is very interesting that I had all these creative juices going when I saw it again. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hi, Christine. Question?
Does anyone have any other thoughts? Any questions for Anna about addiction?
Yeah. Thank you. This is great.
Thank you
so much, Library.
It was very interesting. Thank you.
Yeah.